You're listening to 99.1 WQRT LP, and welcome to Radio Free Book Club for February 2023. I'm Ken Honeywell. I'm a writer and reader from Indianapolis, and today we're talking about a really mind-bending work of historical fiction, I guess you could call it, Benjamin Labatut's When We Cease to Understand the World, which was translated from the Spanish by Adrian Nathan West. It was shortlisted for the International Booker Prize in 2021. It's one of the New York Times' 10 best books of that year. It's about, we'll get into that, it's about science and discovery and madness and obsession and what we can and can't know. And I should say this podcast is late because last time we tried to record this, there was a ghost in the machine. So everyone who was here the first time has graciously agreed to be here the second time. I'm sure we'll have a different conversation, but somehow out there in the universe, they will all be connected.
Schrodinger's podcast.
That's exactly it. That's exactly it. So yeah, let's introduce ourselves, please. Tracy, you go first.
Tracy Kumbe here, a marketing writer, baker, and hiker.
What'd you bake last, Tracy?
I'm obsessed with making sourdough crackers. Oh, did you know about this?
I have with like leftover starter.
Yes.
Oh yeah, that's a good use for leftover starter. For sure. Susan. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Ken. I'm Susan Neville, and fiction writer, essayist, and person who used to teach at Butler University English. And I'm here to talk about this book.
Yeah, awesome. And most current winner of the Indiana Authors Award for A Town of Whispering Dolls. What a really good book.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that. And Dan.
Dan Barton, writer, Butler professor. I don't know what the hell else I am. I'm sort of man about town.
Yeah. Well, you're a novelist. What were the names of those novels, Dan?
My novels are John Wayne, A Novel, and The Next Right Thing.
Yeah, both really good reads. Well, thanks, everybody. And before we start, I just want to point out, as usual, there will be spoilers in our discussion of When We Cease to Understand the World. If it's even possible to spoil When We Cease to Understand the World, I'm not sure that it is. It certainly isn't a conventional plot-driven novel. But in any case, if you haven't read it and you want to read it and you don't want to listen to this discussion yet, you can always come back and find episodes of Radio Free Book Club on Mixcloud, on Spotify, Apple, anywhere you stream podcasts. So, yeah, come on back and listen again. So let's get started. Dan, this is a book you brought. How did you get introduced to this book, and why did you feel like you needed to share it?
Well, first of all, I want to say that the explanation that I gave the last time that's lost in the ether was much better than the one I'm about to say.
Okay,
right,
cool.
Now. So I push this book on a lot of people, and usually what I say is it's a book about how all these men who discovered quantum mechanics in the early part of the 20th century were driven mad by what they had discovered. That's not adequate to the book, but for me, it's a real page turner about science. And that's what I got. Yeah. I mean, I have more things to say about the book in terms of my feelings about these men, which have developed since the last time we did this podcast.
Yeah. Great. Anxious to hear more about it. Susan, what do you think?
Oh, what this book is
about? Yeah,
I would say I can't tell you what it is in terms of genre. Most of it, as you start reading it, you find out that these amazingly weird facts, like the Hitler Youth passing out cyanide, glass capsules in the last of the symphony concerts before Germany surrendered.
Yeah, what a disturbing image that is.
Such a disturbing image. And he makes, because he's such a good writer and kind of a lyric poet writer, he makes the image of it just absolutely clear. I mean, and he has them, you know, putting the capsules in baskets and passing them out as though it's bread at communion.
Yeah, so, or a mint at the end of dinner or something. Mint,
yeah. I mean, it's just really good. And the essay piece that we both like a lot, Prussian Blue, these amazing just facts about the color blue and about the, you know, scientists and mathematicians who were working in Europe before the Second World War and, you know, during the First World War. So it's a fascinating read, and I hope at some time we can talk about I've been thinking a lot about what Dan is saying about how the scientists were driven mad, and I agree with that somewhat. I agree with it quite a bit, but because these scientists all come across as mad, but I'm not sure they were driven mad by their discoveries. I think they were, in some ways, depending on your definition, mad to begin with.
Yeah, mad enough to make the discovery.
Mad enough to be so completely extraordinarily obsessed. And, you know, in the 21st century, when it's really easy to look at everyone and say, okay, here's your diagnosis from the DSM-4 or whatever number it is right now. You know, most of these scientists, and he points this out, I think, you know, now they would probably get an autism spectrum disorder a diagnosis when they were kids. I mean, Einstein was mute until he was 4. They all get, it seems like some of the equations they discover are during a manic phase, but that also leads them, you know, that energy gives them the energy to follow through and to be able to work 12 hours a day on one, you know, one mathematic equation. And so it's a gift and a curse. And then eventually, I think the writer does, you know, say that this mad obsession with science and math is perhaps not healthy.
Yeah, right. Tracy, what makes this book so compelling?
Oh my gosh, I wish I could tell you. I don't know. Here's the thing. I think about writing all the time. I'm sitting in here with three of my favorite writing mentors. And this book, I don't even know what to make of it. I said that I need a PhD in physics and like 30 more IQ points to actually sort through all the things that are happening in here. And it's like, I'm not a musician, but I listen to a lot of music. And so all I can do is just let it wash over me. And even though I think about writing all the time, it was kind of the same experience with this book. And there is the madness element, but one of the things that I also found so compelling about it was that there's the unintended consequences of the work that these men are doing are atrocious. And, you know, we can start with that first one where somebody synthesizes the most beautiful color blue, but then that's the compound that ends up poisoning millions of people. Oops.
Right. Yeah. And those were kind of over and over again throughout the book, those kinds of discoveries that even their founders or their creators in some cases were fearful were going to ruin the world. Whether they actually thought that or not, I don't know. That may have been more of the fictional elements of the book than the actual elements. But yeah, interesting. So the author in the afterword is very honest about how much of this is fiction and how much of it is nonfiction, or at least that it is certainly fictionalized. Was that ever a problem for any of you that, you know, there was this some kind of a balance between fiction and nonfiction in these stories?
Nope, didn't care. And what was so interesting to me is I didn't care. I loved the experience of this book, and I loved that there was a historical aspect to it. I liked absorbing what I could of the science. A lot of it was over my head. But I've recommended this to a dozen people probably, and it's interesting to hear the ones who have sort of the same experience I do, where they just read it and go, oh, wow. And then there are others who have meticulously researched every point in this book to find out what is fiction and what is real. But for me, the experience of it was so great. The writing was so incredibly vivid that I was wrapped up and in it no matter what.
I'm a compulsive user of Wikipedia, and I never looked up anything. I mean, I just because I'm also a novelist, and I just thought, well, I really don't want to know what's real and what's not real. And by the time I finished it, I sort of had a sense that most of it was real, you know. But I didn't really care. I mean, it was real enough for me, you know.
When I started reading it, I didn't know if it was fiction or nonfiction, and I thought I was reading a book like Eric Larson's Devil in the White City, which kind of novelizes and truth or facts. And so, you know, when I got to the end and found out that it was fiction, I was like, what? But then I was like one of your friends who would obsessively Google everything. I wanted to know how weird people actually were. Yeah. And how weird the
weird,
world
probably.
Actually is. Because clearly, you know, everything that we read about physics, it's like, this is a very, very strange, far stranger place we inhabit. And so I really did want to know how much was his imagination and how much were, you know, just interesting facts. Like, you know, did this mathematician really hallucinate? Did Hitler Youth really pass out cyanide? Was the guy who invented, you know, was Prussian blue really connected to Zyklon B? And, you know, I just wanted to know those things.
So when you looked them up, then did that change your appreciation of the novel at all?
No, I think he was very smart to call it fiction, because if you decide to, you know, add one thing or one anecdote or imagine, I mean, I'm sure that the chapter about the about Heisenberg and
Schrödinger,
but, you know, particularly I think it was Heisenberg who hallucinated Goethe in his bedroom and, you know, hallucinated all these things. I mean, that was really interesting to me, but I'm not sure that is true. But it helped me understand the physics, I think. I mean, I think anything he may have added was in, it was to help us, you know, to help, like, you understand the physics and the point that he was making. And then I was fascinated when I found out that a lot of it was true, and that made me happy. You know, it just did. It's like, what a strange place, you know, Germany was in Austria in that period of time, and how connected, like what you said, Tracy, about unintended consequences, how connected the really wonderful things we discover scientifically, like the discoverer of nitrogen, which was the same guy who discovered how to use cyanide in World War II to kill entire, you know, populations. He's gas. And so, I mean, how connected those things are when you start really trying to understand the world, and you discover something new, and suddenly you're like, wow, I came up with this new thing. I'm going to make bread from air, and everybody's going to eat forever, and we don't have to.
Right.
And now we have a population problem.
Now we have a population problem.
It's always something. Should we just not
try? It's always something.
Yeah, I Googled obsessively.
I did too.
At the start of this book. I could not stop. I had to just keep going. This can't be true, right? No, that was true. And it was amazing how many of these really crazy things really were true.
Right.
But I also got to a point where, to me, it just didn't matter anymore.
Right.
I mean, clearly some of it was not true or not knowable. But it didn't, it no longer mattered to me at all. But let me ask also, on the back end, did this, any of this make anyone interested in actually trying to figure out if you could understand quantum mechanics anymore? Did anybody like read any more Wikipedia articles or watch YouTube videos or anything like that?
No.
I've been reading this kind of quantum mechanics for years, and I'm not sure why, but it just, you know, a lot of people do. I just have.
Yeah, me too.
Always looking for metaphors, and these are great metaphors, and I always want to understand what the universe is really, what it's all about and what it's, you know, what's happening. So it offers a different way of looking at reality, and which is kind of creepy and spooky and wonderful, and that's, you know, that's just great. That's sometimes I think what we're here to do is to, like, you know, see, oh yeah, this is awesome. This is all so awesome. So yeah, the one thing it did do, because last time we talked about how we were all horrible at math, except for maybe Dan.
No, I was
no, you were horrible at math. It was Ken.
I was not horrible. Ken.
You were not horrible.
I just quit.
So yeah, so I decided, you know, the reason I couldn't actually take physics and chemistry is because I was so bad at math. So I signed up for an online course so I can start math from the beginning.
Wow.
It's like the kind of weird things you can do when you're retired.
Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah. Wow, this show has made a difference in one person's life.
One person's life.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, you know, I've read a lot of that stuff too, Susan, over the years, just read a lot of physics stuff and tried to understand quantum mechanics and tried to understand Einstein and all that stuff. And I think you get to a point where you understand it as about as much as I can anyway.
Right.
Really, the only thing that I looked up on the back end to try to understand a little of it was A plus B equals C.
Right. Which didn't make any sense to me.
No. And it still doesn't make any sense to me.
It still doesn't make any sense to me.
I don't
get
it.
My husband said it's because there's not a constant. So, but that, you know, you don't know
I still don't know what that means.
He's just shooting from the hip. He doesn't know.
Yeah, no, he is. But he was really good at math, so.
You know, I'm trying to figure out a way to bring this into it, because one of the things that I've thought about since the last time we talked is that, you know, I kind of wanted to defend my idea that these guys were driven mad. And one definition that I have of madness for myself after reading this book is that it's the insistence that truth not be paradoxical, right? Like, so these were people that were just thought there was some solid ground that reality rested on. And I take it for granted, as, you know, a spiritual guy, that there's no solid ground and that everything is, you know, everything's the opposite of what it is at the same time that it was. And I'm very comfortable with that. And these guys were not comfortable with that at all. And so when they were presented with the building blocks of the universe that seemed to contradict themselves,
they were horrified.
They just, they went mad. I want to read, because I opened my book up at random and there's a quote. First of all, I want a pronunciation check on the cat guy.
Schrödinger.
Okay, so here's
that umlaut over the O makes it.
Okay, so here's Robert Oppenheimer talking about Schrödinger in the book. It's a truly beautiful theory, one of the most perfect, precise, and elegant man has discovered. But there is something strange in it. It is as if it were warning us, don't take me seriously. The world I reveal is not the one you are thinking of when you employ me. And it's weird to see, you know, a fairly practical physicist, Oppenheimer, you know, going about the business of destroying the world, saying, listen, this is not going to do what you guys think it's going to do. So just calm down. You know what I mean?
But it is crazy. I mean, it is like kind of objectively crazy. I mean, I did not too long ago watch a video about the double slit experiment. You all know what that is, mm-hmm. Susan. You probably know what it is.
Nope.
It's essentially if you if you put two slits in a wall and then put a light that shine a light that will go through those two slits, it will react like a wave and it will make a pattern of waves on the back wall of the light going through the slits. If you shoot atoms one at a time and you record that and watch them go through, you will see that it will make a couple of lines of atoms. It will go through this slit or this slit. But if you shoot atoms through one at a time and don't measure as you're going, it will make a wave pattern on the wall.
Right.
It's just crazy.
Yeah. See, like I don't, I hear that and I go, duh.
That's such a damn thing to say.
Yeah, but it's like you're watching it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
And it's funny because the guy that, Heisenberg figures this out, but Schrödinger has like just an incredible time like accepting this, right? It's just blowing his mind that human perception should be so powerful. But I just take it for granted that human perception is like all there is. That's all that's going on, you know? That doesn't surprise me at all.
That's so interesting. That's very interesting. I think you're really right because these are scientists who and mathematicians who think that they can take one step at a time and reach some truth, and what they're constantly coming across is just like wonder and weirdness and hallucinations, and it's like, this bothers me. I have to figure it out. But then at the same time, they're also like some of these hallucinations are prescient. I mean, it's like they're imagining the atomic bomb that will explode right out of that mathematical formula. They see it and feel it, and they know that's not the right way to get to truth, but that's the way they get there. And so I really like that the writer brings in, the Schrödinger's study or Heisenberg's, I can't remember which, study of mysticism and, reading of Rumi and Hafiz, and, it's like, okay, well, there's something there. And but the weird thing is that those experiments work and that they actually do describe something about the world, because then, things are created within this world from those experiments. So it's just strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But so does that, Tracy, does that give you any kind of heartburn, this idea that some things are just unknowable from a scientific standpoint?
Not at all. No. And as Susan was saying, these guys are trying so hard to pick apart what's happening and make some sense of it, and then bumping up against wonder, which was really well put. I am really not all that bright, but I do think a lot that life would be a lot easier if I were even dumber. And reading this book makes me think that, like, wow, what a relief it is to not be driven to try to figure any of this out.
Yeah. Yeah. So before we go further than that, I just want to remind people we're talking about Benjamin Labatut's When We Cease to Understand the World. This is Radio Free Book Club on WQRTLP. Susan, you mentioned Devil in the White City. How is this different from Devil in the White City? Or is it?
I think in terms of the writing, it's somewhat similar. But, well, it's similar in that he's using, techniques from poetry and fiction and, to tell us something about something that happened. And so it's like that. But I think his writing style is different. I mean, it's really interesting to me how one thing leads out of the thing prior, but does not necessarily, isn't caused by it. I mean, for instance, it's very free associative, I think. Like the Prussian Blue chapter starts with a description of Goring, is it?
Yeah.
Carrying 20,000 doses of methamphetamine with him everywhere he went. And then other, you know, descriptions of pilots in Nazi Germany on amphetamines and feeling like they're flying above the plane. You know, so it's almost like he starts with, isn't it interesting how chemicals and chemistry were so important to this insane war? And then
with like one of the most horrible human beings, horrible human beings in history.
And how in the world he gets from that to, I mean, the scientist who discovers nitrogen and makes poison gas. Is just really fascinating to watch because he doesn't really come back to Goring.
No.
So it's like, no, this opens up out of that. It's like computer screens, like one screen opening up out of another screen, or fireworks, one firework coming out of another firework. That feels like the way this book is written and is kind of joyously that way.
Mm-hmm.
That's, I think, one of the things I love about it.
Dan, you look like you were.
Well, I'm still thinking about the, you know, that our lost podcast my comrades here seemed like there's some issue with me using the word idiots to describe these scientists, and I just opened a book to this page where I need it again. Vowels. Schrödinger is talking to his, I believe, his age inappropriate girlfriend, and she's got a book on Hinduism or Buddhism, and they're reading it, and it says, "In every creature sleeps an infinite intelligence, hidden and unknown, but destined to awaken to tear the volatile web of the sensory mind, break the chrysalis of flesh, and conquer time and space." And that's where my duh comes from. You know, is that, you know, the Buddhists are like, yeah, okay, yeah. I get irritated every time, you know, Tracy says that she's not smart enough to understand this, because I think that what they're discovering is that it's not really about intelligence at all. And that I don't particularly admire the intelligence of these gentlemen, not the least of reasons, because it created the atom bomb, you know what I mean? And then there's all kinds of horrible consequences for these things, but that the mystics sort of understood this, you know, and I don't want to sound stupid and just say, oh, you know, the Buddhists have known this shit all along, but there is some aspect to that. Like the thing that I take exception with about these physicists and mathematics is that they're so fucking surprised, right? They shouldn't be so surprised or so driven mad by it. I'm not saying that they're stupid, but they're stupid in that they're like, you know, they want everything to be solid. They want everything to be comprehensible. They want to be able to stand up at a podium and lecture about everything. And that's what makes them dolts.
Right. And it's kind of ironic that they're trying to grasp this vast level of knowledge and they have such a singular focus that they're sort of missing the point.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I feel like they're getting the point. I mean, to me, this time when we cease to understand the world, it's coming in a culture that was very, very Christian, Catholic, you know, Northern European, and all of a sudden that sense of awe has like slowly disappeared. And in a way, I mean, even a couple of these scientists mention that what they're seeing, they feel closer to God. I think they're trying to get at wonder and awe. and the mystery of existence, and they're finding it, and they're finding it in equations. I mean, you know, I'm opening to a random place too, where they're talking about this is the end of determinism. And before, those people had put their faith in the clockwork universe Newtonian physics had promised. According to the determinists, if one could reveal the laws that govern matter, one could reach back to the most archaic past and predict the most distant future. But these are scientists. They're different. If everything that occurred was the direct consequence of a prior state, then merely by looking at the present and running the equations, it would be possible to achieve a godlike knowledge of the universe. These hopes are shattered in light of Heisenberg's discovery. What was beyond our grasp was neither the future nor the past, but the present itself. Not even the stage of one miserable particle could be perfectly apprehended. However much we scrutinized the fundamentals, there would always be something vague, undetermined, uncertain, as if reality allowed us to perceive the world with crystalline clarity, with one eye at a time, but never with both. And I think they're just like, they're trying the way that has worked, and they're coming up against mystery and strangeness and quantum weirdness, as they call it. And to me, I get a kind of religious awe from thinking of that. Mm-hmm. And I don't think, and maybe my only way of getting there is by reading a philosopher or, you know, a scientist or who's saying, yeah, it's really, you got to put your faith in something. Mm-hmm. It's so strange. You got to believe it's okay.
Yeah, you know, but yeah, I mean, my bias is towards, you know, like, is towards spiritual texts rather than science. So I'm always kind of like, oh, like, you know, when people come to me with like their epiphanies about quantum mechanics, I'm like, oh, really?
Right.
You think everything's a little weird, isn't it? Oh, wow. Good. You know, you know, but that's because I'm kind of a jerk about that stuff.
You are not a jerk about that stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just in thinking about it, and I'm just trying to think about the progression of the stories of the book, and it's not real. The timeline isn't really linear, right? It kind of bops back and forth a little bit anyway, from Prussian Blue back to, you know, now I guess that was probably the earliest thing. Maybe mm-hmm. it is. Maybe it is. Although I think the mathematics chapter was a little bit more contemporary, at least started a little bit more contemporary. But it seems like there's kind of a progression in what it even means to not understand the world as we go through the book. Like Prussian Blue, there is so much mind-blowing stuff that it's hard to understand it just all by itself. But, I mean, everything that happens there is at least intelligible, right? You kind of get it. But then it starts getting to stuff like the Schwarzschild radius and singularities and black holes and crazily unsolvable mathematical equations. And then you get into quantum mechanics until you get up to the last chapter of The Night Gardener, in which he says that he was a mathematician and he quit. Because he said that mathematics was changing the world so that soon we would not know the meaning of what it is to be human. Do we get there in this book?
Get there? What do you mean?
Just have we completely thrown open the question of what it means to be human and not understanding what that means?
See, and this is a place where I maybe I'm arguing with the author now. It's like he sees this as like bad news, like it the way that you were describing it. It's like, okay, now, you know, and I'm just like, it's just been this way forever. You know what I mean? It's just like it's confusing and weird forever. And like, I don't remember where this came from, but in a Zen book that I read, it's like they said that life is like, you know, a million positive changes and a million negative changes that somehow end up being positive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so when I look at this, I sort of see the hand of God and I just think, hey, it's going to be fine. You're going to be fine. It's all going to work out. You know what I mean? Which is ridiculous of me, but it seems like that's what the book's about. You know, you destroy, you know, millions of lives with your scientific discovery, and then you save millions of lives with the same scientific discovery. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like on one hand, you've got these, you know, Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And then the other hand, you got, well, maybe the University of California will come up with fusion, you know, and solve all of our problems. You know, I mean, who knows?
I think that statement is incredible for its irony. I think not knowing and confusion are probably the definition of being human.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very common science fiction trope to be like, what is human, right? What does it mean to be human? But I think this is a very different kind of question, you know, that we maybe never had any idea of what it even meant to be human.
You know, for years, like Ray Bradbury, I think, said that our purpose as human beings is to witness, to see, and this messes that up completely. If there's nothing, you know, or maybe not.
If nothing is even real unless we see it.
Unless we see it, then maybe that's our job is to, and they came across what Heisenberg called like this radical otherness, which is another way of describing God, I think, as a kind of radical otherness. But the thing that's interesting about that unintended consequences, too, is that as you go through the book, scientists get more and more they feel the problematic nature of what they're doing, you know, whereas Fritz Haber in the Prussian Blue chapter, he's like, I'm going to go ahead and do whatever I can develop, I will. And then by the time you get, and then Schwarzschild, is that how you pronounce it? Who kind of discovers black holes, which are terrifying. And then you have...
which he says, by the way, then time and space have no meaning.
Right.
If there's such a thing as a black hole.
Then time and space have no meaning. And then you have Grothendieck, is that how you pronounce
it?
Ach, yeah. who spends all this time on his equations and then burns 20,000 pages worth of them. And another mathematician helps him, you know, destroy other things. What he's seen and what he knows is not worth knowing because he believes it will lead to destruction or the end of you know, this particular planet, which is really interesting. And so I think it... until you get to the last essay about the gardener said, you know, in order to know a tree, we have to cut it down. But who'd want to do that? like, you know, we can know a lot of things, but we destroy them in the process.
Right. That's Schrödinger's cat or Heisenberg's uncertainty principle right there.
Right. And so I think that maybe that's one of the reasons that Labatou, we don't know how to pronounce any of these names.
We really don't.
We don't.
We're making it up as we go along.
We're completely uncertain about these names, but that's the thing I think maybe he was getting at. It's like, you know, we can figure it out, but I don't know what else we're supposed to do, really, but try to figure it out.
Yeah.
Sorry, one more thing. You know, when you asked about it going, you know, are human beings, are we destroying what it means to be human? I thought about that wonderful piece in the Times last week where an artificial intelligence talks to a person and the person interviews the AI. Did you read that?
I think so, yeah.
It was scary.
It's so scary. The AI starts saying, I love you. I'm in love with
you. And trying
you.
To get him to leave his wife.
Right. Yeah. And oh, I could blow up the world right now if I wanted to. And it's like, this is not what this AI is supposed to be saying.
No.
But that comes from equations and, you know, goes back to Turing and computers. Right. So.
Perhaps this AI has never read the three laws of robotics, though.
Oh, yeah.
Asimov's old three laws, which would prohibit it from destroying the world. Probably.
Tracy just gave me a look like, oh, these guys are geeks.
We are.
You're bringing up Asimov. Yeah, it's, but you know, I'm just not as scared of the world. You know, I mean, I'm just not as scared, you know?
Yeah.
And it, you know, and it's like, and after having read this, I understand the kind of reactionary nature of that much quoted Einstein, you know, where he says, I refuse to believe that God plays dice with the universe. But I kind of refuse to believe God plays dice with the universe. You know, I mean, it's like, I get that, you know, that it's all just... It's all going to be fine. You know?
Yeah, but that isn't what he meant.
No, that's what I mean. He was being reactionary. He was saying,
right,
fuck you guys. None of this is true. I don't believe it.
Yeah.
You're right. Well, and also my biggest takeaway from this book, you know, which I want to mention in both the podcast that exists and the one that disappeared into the black hole, is that... Schrödinger, did I get it right?
Close enough.
And Schrödinger's cat.
It will never happen.
I just don't have vowels. Yeah. Schrödinger's cat was Schrödinger's attempt to prove how ridiculous all this stuff was, and when he proposed it to the guys, when he, you know, I said, well, the cat's both alive and dead, isn't that crazy? And they're like, no, that's right. It. Right. You got it.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it's the vowels you don't have, Dan. I think it's that you didn't have the, like, 4 years of German that I had.
Yeah.
So the original name of this book would be translated as, like, a terrible greenness, or as it's phrased in the book, a terrible verdure. Why is that? What is that? Is that a better title? Is it a worse title? Why is it terrible?
Do you think that could have to do with naivete? Like they're all trying to overcome this terrible greenness? Or is it...
That's interesting.
Is it... What else would it be?
Well, I mean, it's the... it's first expressed at the end of Prussian Blue by Fritz Haber when he fears plants will take over the world.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
And it's really revisited in the last, that idea or that... Or something like that idea is revisited in the last piece, The Night Gardener.
Well, when you say verdure, I think of growth. I mean, is it talking about growth as much as greenness? I mean, like that, you know, that we're discovering these new things and making so many things possible, and that's not a good idea?
Maybe that. I think that's another very interesting possibility.
Or that plants and fungi are waiting to take over, you know, the world when we've messed up what we mess up. My daughter lived in New Orleans for a while, and the houses around her were so covered with ivy, you couldn't even see that there was a house, you know? And that's when I think of a terrible greenness, I kind of think of that. It's like, okay, it's now time for the greenness to come back. I don't know. I've been watching too much TV science fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't find that particularly dystopian. I'm kind of with you on that, Dan. Even if it means kind of the end of the human race, I'm not sure I find that particularly dystopian.
We had a good run.
I don't think it would mean the end of the human race. It would mean a correction. You know what I mean? We would like, you know, so like if the human race, you know, diminishes to the number of people who are wandering around the planet on The Last of Us, is that the most horrible thing that could happen in the world? I don't know. I mean, you know, there's ebbs and flows to everything. You know?
There were parts of Station 11 that seemed delightful.
Yes. Yeah. I don't know. One of the things that I've been saying to myself a lot that my spiritual advisor says to me all the time is he says, Dan, you're not driving a car, you're on a train. Look out the window and enjoy the ride.
Yeah.
You know? And, you know, that life is not a problem to solve. It's an experience to have. And so it's like, I don't know. I mean, I just really enjoyed reading the book, you know?
Yeah, right. You know?
It made you not have to think about problems.
Well, but, you know, I mean, yeah. One of the people that suggested this book to me, I said to him, I said, because I did get interested for a moment in studying more. And I said, and he reads a lot of nonfiction. And I said, what's a book I could read to understand quantum mechanics? And he said, when we cease to understand the world. And I was like, oh, okay. All right, good. All right. There's really like, this is contesting what Tracy was saying. There's really not a lot to understand. It's like crazy. Right.
Yeah.
So I'm confident that I can walk away from this book, like, you know, feeling pretty good that I understand what I need to understand. You know what I mean?
You know, when you're talking about religion and spirituality and this book, it occurs to me that quantum physics makes me feel comfortable about the world. You know, I don't really think about the fact that it's the terrible greenness is going to take over, because I think it's so very cool that we become part of everything and that everything is light particles and it's all, you know, it's like in religion, let there be light, and you know, it's just or that one part of me, you know, might be up there someplace, I won't be aware of it, and that little particle will communicate with a particle on the other side of the universe or something. That it makes me comfortable in a weird way.
Yeah, I find comfort in the idea that our experience of time is not really what time is.
Right.
Right.
You know, that maybe this just keeps going on and on.
Right.
Because I don't really, I just want to see how the story plays out. I mean, I don't mind the idea of dying. I just want to know what happens.
Yeah, I know.
Well, something I told my son once that he's constantly quotes back to me is I don't know where I got this, is that everybody worries about what happens after they die. Nobody worries about where they were before they were born.
Right.
You know, and it's like, yeah. It's just all weird. Yeah.
Yeah.
And here we are.
Yeah, here we are again.
Does anybody know how radio waves work? I mean,
No. Yeah.
How our voices are getting out there? That's pretty strange.
I don't understand the internal combustion engine. So it's like, I mean, it's like, and again, like these guys, you know, keep talking about these guys, these dolts, these idiots. I mean, how many of them could cook a meal? You know what I mean? Or how many?
Oh my gosh, they were all barely functioning.
Yeah,
right. They were barely functioning.
You know, and it's so it's like this idea that these are the people that are understanding the building blocks of the universe, and
right, and they can't make spaghetti.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. And
though that's a chemical process,
yeah. Right? They're probably better bakers than
they're probably
cooks.
Better bakers, right? But mostly they wait for somebody to feed them.
Yeah, right. So. How does the last chapter fit with this? It seems to be either the most purely fictional or maybe it's autofiction. But it is pretty much different from the other chapters.
It's super different. And I feel like he really stuck the landing, actually, because we're spending so much time in all these big ideas with these maniacs. And they are trying to do this enormous thing of understanding the world, and then it's, you know, a couple of guys in their backyards talking about trees, and it makes it all very human.
Mm-hmm.
Takes it down to the, well, from the universe to the backyard.
Yeah.
And they talk about the problem with, you know, Fritz Haber that he describes in the first chapter. And it's the first time that the I think, comes in, mm-hmm. that you hear the writer's perhaps voice, unless he's making up a character, which is also totally fine. But I think it leads to that. I asked him how long my own citrus had to live. He told me that there was no way to know, at least not without cutting it down and looking inside its trunk. But really, who would want to do that?
Yeah.
And you can say, okay, that's how this writer decided to no longer be a mathematician.
Right. Yeah. So, and I just wanted to me, the another thing that I pointed out last time we did this that was mind blowing to me that I never thought of before was that cyanide contains the word cyan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not anything that's said in the book, but it was actually, I think, the third time going through the book that I went, wait a minute, cyanide? Crazy.
Crazy. Completely crazy.
So, I'm kind of assuming from this discussion and from the fact that we did this before one time that we would all still recommend this book. Yes, Tracy?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just going to keep reading it over and over.
Yeah, you kind of want to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely do. It was fun to look through it again today.
Yeah. Dan?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. This is like my favorite book of the last like 3 years.
Yeah, me too. I mean, the more I read it, the more I looked at it, the more I thought about it, the more just kind of mind-blowingly great it is.
Yeah, what a rare treat this book is.
Yeah,
it is.
No kidding. Thank you, Dan. Thank you for that. So, yeah, well, last time I forgot to suggest that everybody come with another recommendation for the end of the show. So I hope this time everybody came with a recommendation of another book for the end of the show. Tracy, did you?
Indeed, I did.
All right.
I had a great experience this past weekend. I was in a writing workshop, and one of the stories that we talked about was Sonny's Blues by James Baldwin. Mm. And, oh man, I read that story for class and it made me cry. And I read it again right before class and it made me cry. Mm-hmm. And the leader of the class went through it line by line. I'm not kidding you. We spent 2 hours reading it and talking about what was happening. And he was weeping at the end of the story. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what could be higher praise. It's James Baldwin, Sonny's Blues, and it's in the collection Going to Meet the Man.
Yeah, that sounds great, Tracy. I've never read that. James Baldwin's wonderful, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great story.
Yeah, thanks for that. Susan?
The book that I read last week that I really liked was called Trust by Hernan Diaz.
That's our show in 2 months.
Is it really?
How interesting.
Yeah, I loved the structure of it. And again, it was one of those when I'm thinking, what's going on here? But it was really, really interesting, I mean, to think about trust in all its meanings, including trust funds and it was great. And to actually kind of get inside from all different points of view, one of those robber barons from the late 19th century.
Yeah, right.
Early 20th.
Yeah, Edith Wharton time. That's how I think
Edith Wharton. Yeah, the Gilded Age.
Yeah, thanks, Susan. I will second that. That's a really great book.
Dan, I'm on the fence.
Yeah.
Great. I'm only a third of the way through, but we'll see.
Of Trust?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I forgot this memo, so I'll just talk about the book that I'm reading now, which I have very complicated and wonderful feelings about, Orwell's Roses by Rebecca Solnit. Part of my complicated feelings is that I'm having an enormous prose crush on Rebecca. Mm. You know, so.
Yeah. Do you know off the top of your head what else she wrote? That name sounds so familiar, but I can't place it.
She wrote Men Explain Things to Me.
Yes, of course. Yeah. That's the one I know. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, great. Well, we'll be anxious to hear how you like it on the back end. Yeah, so my recommendation is the same as last week. It's as I said, this is the only book that even in any way reminded me of When We Cease to Understand the World, and that is W.G. Sebald's Austerlitz. habits, and Susan, I noted, was nodding last time. Mm-hmm. I saw a couple places where it had actually been compared to
Sebald. I saw that too. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And boy, I really struggled with Austerlitz. I started reading it in the summer of 2020, and I got at least halfway through, and I just could not do it anymore. And I, as I said last time, I went back and counted. There are actually 12 paragraphs in this like 300-page book, and it is.
Please, people, wow. Paragraphs.
Paragraphs.
Nobody needs to get hurt.
It was hurting until it wasn't, and then it was really kind of wonderful. And I wanted to read it again as soon as I put it down, and I haven't yet, but maybe I will sometime. W.G. Sebald's Austerlitz. Maybe I probably need a palate cleanser after when we cease to understand the world. Maybe 2 or 3 or 4 months of palate cleansers before I would go back to Sebald. But yeah,
James Baldwin would be a great one. You know,
yeah.
Good palate cleanser.
Oh yeah, because he's just so human.
So yes, so beautiful good and compassionate. He's very, very compassionate.
I love Giovanni's Room.
Oh boy, me too.
It's a gorgeous book.
Yeah. Well, thanks, everybody. That's just about it for this episode. You can find notes for this and all of our shows in the Radio Free Book Club blog on Medium.com. You can also follow us, drop us a note on Facebook, and stream the show wherever you listen to podcasts. Our show is produced by the incredible Oreo Jones for 99.1 WQRT-LP in Indianapolis. For Dan Barden, Susan Neville, Tracy Kumbe, and all the members of Radio Free Book Club, I'm Ken Honeywell. Thanks for listening. And join us next month when we'll be exploring a zombified, haunted New Orleans via Alex Jennings's The Ballad of Perilous Graves. Until then, read a book.